In 1996, physicist Alan Sokol submitted an article to the cultural studies journal Social Text, filled with deliberate nonsense and absurdities about quantum gravity having liberatory political implications. Sokol's paper was nonetheless published in a special issue meant to rebut criticisms of postmodernism by distinguished scientists. When Sokol revealed his hoax, it ignited a firestorm that extended far beyond academic circles, making headlines in the New York Times, Le Monde, and newspapers worldwide. The ensuing book, Fashionable Nonsense, became a cultural phenomenon that Stephen Hawking praised as an entertaining and revealing exposé. The controversy even prompted the French Minister of National Education to commission a report on the state of intellectual discourse. Beyond its academic impact, the book has influenced how we think about the relationship between science and culture, with figures ranging from Richard Dawkins to Noam Chomsky citing it as essential reading for understanding the dangers of intellectual obfuscation. At the heart of Sokol and Brickmont's critique lies a simple but devastating observation. Prominent postmodern intellectuals repeatedly abuse scientific and mathematical concepts in their writings. This abuse manifests in multiple distinct but equally problematic forms, each undermining academic integrity in its own way. Some theorists pontificate on scientific theories they barely understand, like Lacan's nonsensical claims about topology representing the structure of mental disease, a statement that reveals fundamental misunderstandings of both topology and psychiatric conditions. Others import scientific concepts into humanities without justification, as when Kristeva attempts to apply set theory to poetic language without establishing any meaningful connection between mathematical structures and linguistic patterns. Many throw around technical terms to intimidate non-specialist readers. Baudrillard's invented phrases like hyperspace with multiple refractivity exemplify this tendency, creating an illusion of depth through scientific-sounding jargon. Perhaps most egregiously, some manipulate meaningless phrases with apparent indifference to their actual meaning, as when Irigaray suggests Einstein's E equals mc squared might be a sexed equation because it privileges the speed of light over other speeds, a claim that demonstrates profound misunderstanding of physics while attempting to force scientific concepts into irrelevant ideological frameworks. What makes these abuses particularly troubling is how they exploit scientific prestige to give philosophical discourse a false veneer of rigor and authority. When Lacan writes equations where psychological concepts like signifier and signified are treated as mathematical variables, he's not advancing psychological understanding, but rather misappropriating mathematical notation. Similarly, when Deleuze invokes differential calculus while fundamentally misunderstanding its basic principles, he demonstrates not interdisciplinary mastery, but intellectual dishonesty. These aren't isolated incidents, but rather represent a systematic pattern of misusing scientific concepts to create an impression of scholarly sophistication. This pattern reveals a deeper and more troubling issue, a privileging of theory, formalism, and wordplay over observation and empirical validation. In fields that would benefit from empirical grounding, like psychoanalysis, this approach substitutes textual analysis and conceptual speculation for scientific testing. The consequences are far-reaching. Students are taught to revere impenetrable prose rather than seek clear understanding. Academic discourse becomes increasingly divorced from reality, and genuine interdisciplinary dialogue is replaced by superficial appropriation of scientific terminology. The result isn't interdisciplinary insight, but intellectual mystification, texts that become sacred scripture for reverent disciples rather than contributions to human knowledge. This approach has created entire academic subcultures where the ability to deploy complex terminology matters more than the ability to demonstrate actual understanding or produce verifiable results. The damage extends beyond academia into public discourse, where this pseudo-scientific language can be used to lend false credibility to various social and political claims. By cloaking arguments in scientific terminology while abandoning scientific methodology, these writers create a dangerous form of intellectual authority that resists both empirical testing and rational critique. Jacques Lacan stands as perhaps the most influential psychoanalyst of the late 20th century, with dozens of books analyzing his work and devoted followers worldwide. While his purely psychoanalytic contributions remain controversial, his mathematical references provide perfect examples of intellectual abuse. Lacan was particularly obsessed with topology, the mathematics of properties that remain unchanged when objects are deformed without tearing. At a 1966 conference, he claimed the Möbius strip represents the knot which constitutes the subject, and asserted that different topological surfaces explain many things about the structure of mental disease. When questioned whether this was merely an analogy, Lacan insisted, "It is not an analogy, it is reality itself." This extraordinary claim comes with no justification. Why would a mathematical surface have any connection to mental illness? Lacan never explains. Instead, he misuses mathematical concepts like compactness, claiming it somehow relates to the impossibility of sexual relationship. His definition of compactness, "The intersection of everything enclosed therein is accepted as existing over an infinite number of sets," is complete gibberish to mathematicians. Lacan's mathematical preoccupations extended beyond topology to include imaginary numbers and mathematical logic. In a 1959 seminar, he confusingly described human life as a calculus in which zero was irrational, while erroneously conflating irrational numbers with imaginary numbers. Later, he introduced bizarre psychoanalytic algebra involving signifiers and the square root of -1, writing equations where psychological concepts were treated as mathematical variables. In one particularly striking passage, he equated the erectile organ with -1, claiming it symbolizes the place of jouissance and restores by the coefficient of its statement to the function of lack of signifier, -1, mathematical formulations that have no coherent meaning. When addressing mathematical logic, Lacan sometimes appeared more restrained but still made questionable connections. Discussing natural numbers, he initially referenced legitimate debates between Hume and Frege, but quickly veered into obscurity with peculiar interpretations of number genesis. Without providing substantive reasoning, he abruptly linked these mathematical concepts to psychoanalysis, claiming, "The question of the two is for us the question of the subject." What emerges is a troubling pattern. Lacan displays superficial erudition while offering no substantive theoretical bridge between mathematics and psychoanalysis. His work increasingly became cryptic combinations of wordplay with fractured syntax, sacred texts for reverent disciples, rather than scientific contributions. The misuse of scientific concepts by postmodern thinkers reflects a broader relativist zeitgeist in academia, the belief that truth is merely relative to individuals or social groups. This epistemic relativism, concerning facts rather than morals or aesthetics, stems partly from works by philosophers like Thomas Kuhn and Paul Feyerabend, though their texts are often ambiguously interpreted. Relativism faces fundamental problems when confronted with scientific practice. How can we attain objective knowledge when we only have direct access to our sensations? While we can't definitively prove the external world exists, it's a reasonable hypothesis. The persistence of our sensations suggests external causes. Similarly, radical skepticism questions whether our sensations accurately reflect reality. But this skepticism applies universally to all knowledge. We reject such skepticism in daily life because the coherence of our experience is best explained by assuming the world roughly corresponds to our sensory perceptions. Scientific method isn't radically different from rational thinking in everyday life. Historians, detectives, and plumbers use the same basic methods of induction, deduction, and evidence assessment as scientists. Science simply conducts these operations more systematically with controls, statistical tests, and precise measurements. The coherence between scientific theories and observations provides compelling evidence for their approximate truth. Quantum electrodynamics predicts the electron's magnetic moment to incredible precision, 1.001159652201000000030, matching experimental results, 1.001159652188000000004. Such agreement would be miraculous if science said nothing true about the world. The crisis in 20th century epistemology stems largely from attempts to formalize scientific method, followed by skepticism when these formalizations proved inadequate. Popper's falsificationism, the idea that scientific theories must make falsifiable predictions, provides a useful demarcation criterion but comes problematic when taken too literally. Two major difficulties arise. First, Popper's rejection of induction contradicts scientific practice, where theories gain credibility through successful predictions. Second, falsification itself is more complex than it appears. Scientific propositions can't be tested individually, since empirical predictions require numerous additional assumptions about measurement devices and background theories. The Duhem-Quine thesis states that theories are underdetermined by evidence, since we have only finite data, but theories make potentially infinite predictions. This is like having a finite set of points with infinitely many curves passing through them. In practice, we face three scenarios: evidence so strong that doubting would be unreasonable, competing theories with none fully convincing, or no plausible theory accounting for all data. What ultimately convinces us we found the right theory is when new data fit our predictions. The strong program in sociology of science faces a fundamental dilemma. When Barnes and Bloor suggest evaluating beliefs without regard to the sociologist's own standards, they create an ambiguity. If they merely suggest using the same principles to explain all beliefs regardless of truth value, this is unobjectionable. But their apparent claim that only social causes matter, that nature itself cannot enter explanations, is deeply problematic. When examining why European scientists accepted Newtonian mechanics between 1700 to 1750, social factors certainly played a role, but a crucial part of the explanation must be that planets actually do move as Newton predicted. Similarly, if someone runs screaming about elephants in a lecture hall, our explanation depends fundamentally on whether elephants are actually there. Bruno Latour exemplifies this confusion in his Science in Action, where he presents the third rule of method. Since the settlement of a controversy is the cause of nature's representation, not the consequence, we can never use the outcome, nature, to explain how and why a controversy has been settled. This formulation slips between nature's representation and nature itself, creating multiple possible interpretations ranging from truism to radical idealism. When discussing scientific controversies like the solar neutrino problem, Latour mocks the idea that nature decides outcomes, instead suggesting sociologists can understand everything there is to understand in technoscience by analyzing power struggles between researchers. This approach fundamentally confuses facts with our knowledge of them. Scientists do use nature as an external referee. They design experiments specifically to discover what is happening in nature. Relativism's practical consequences extend beyond abstract philosophy, affecting criminal investigations, education, and development in the third world. When applied to criminal cases, relativism creates absurd confusions, as when an anthropologist claimed both a policeman and judge were telling their truth about a file transmission in a Belgian murder case, ignoring that only one factual reality exists. In education, relativist textbooks redefine facts as mere consensus interpretations that change with theories, undermining critical thinking. Most harmfully, postmodern relativism damages third world development, where intellectuals may hypocritically use Western science for themselves while encouraging common people to follow superstitions. Luce Irigaray claims scientific knowledge displays choices determined by the sex of scholars involved. Her examples from physics, however, reveal profound misunderstandings of science. She makes bizarre connections between psychoanalytic concepts and nuclear fission, falsely claims Nietzsche perceived his ego as an atomic nucleus, impossible given the timeline, invents meaningless physics terminology like accelerations without electromagnetic re-equilibrations, confuses general relativity with special relativity, and misrepresents quantum mechanics as being interested in the disappearance of the world. Most absurdly, she proposes that E equals mc squared might be a sexed equation because it privileges the speed of light over other speeds that are vitally necessary to us. Irigaray argues fluid mechanics is underdeveloped compared to solid mechanics because of gender bias, solidity being associated with masculinity and fluidity with femininity. She claims science's inability to fully model turbulent flow stems from this gendered bias. Her American interpreter, Hales, explains that Irigaray sees the privileging of solid mechanics as reflecting male anatomy, rigid organs, over female, fluid-producing openings. This reasoning fundamentally misunderstands scientific practice. Solid mechanics remains incomplete, fracture mechanics, while fluid mechanics has well-established equations, Navier-Stokes, whose difficulty solving turbulent flows stems from mathematical complexity, not any powerlessness of logic or failure of adequate symbolization. Irigaray extends her critique to mathematical logic, claiming scientific concepts refer only to an intra-theoretical object, creating a fictional universe incomprehensible to outsiders. The authors counter that scientific theories must connect to reality to have empirical consequences, and many concepts are accessible to non-experts through popularizations. Irigaray's attempt to analyze mathematical notation proves both pedantic and comically inaccurate. She misidentifies basic symbols, confuses logical operators, and fundamentally misunderstands quantifiers in logic. She falsely claims mathematics lacks signs for difference other than quantitative, reciprocity, exchange, and fluidity, revealing her profound ignorance of basic mathematical concepts. Her scientific confusions support her broader philosophical claim that science is masculine, leading her to reject truth independent of the subject and discourage women from pursuing universal science. The authors condemn her mystical appeals to women's cosmic rhythms as reinforcing the sexist stereotypes feminism has fought against. Claims that recent scientific developments have fundamentally changed the nature of science itself rest on similar confusions. Lyotard's attempt to establish a postmodern science fails through conceptual misunderstanding. He incorrectly suggests that scale-dependent measurements create absolutely incompatible statements, rather than recognizing this as a standard feature of macroscopic quantities. For example, measuring temperature at different scales, atomic versus planetary, yields different but complementary insights, not contradictions. When addressing fractal geometry and catastrophe theory, Lyotard provides no evidence that these mathematical advances challenge traditional scientific epistemology. Rather, they extend and enrich existing mathematical frameworks. Chaos theory examines deterministic systems that exhibit extreme sensitivity to initial conditions. In chaotic systems, prediction errors grow exponentially rather than linearly, severely limiting predictability. For instance, in weather forecasting, tiny measurement uncertainties double approximately every 3 days, making accurate long-term predictions impossible. Even with vastly improved measurement precision, the prediction window extends only marginally. Doubling precision adds just one doubling time to predictability. Surprisingly, even simple systems with few variables can exhibit chaotic behavior, such as the famous three-body problem in celestial mechanics or the logistic equation modeling population growth. However, this doesn't represent a limit of science. Many natural systems are non-chaotic, and statistical methods can still yield understanding of chaotic systems. Planetary orbits, chemical reactions, and numerous physical phenomena remain highly predictable. The crucial distinction between determinism and predictability is often overlooked. Determinism concerns what nature does independently of us, while predictability depends partly on our knowledge. A chaotic system follows strict deterministic laws even when we cannot predict its behavior precisely. Many confusions arise from misunderstanding linear and nonlinear terms. Newton's supposedly linear thought actually uses nonlinear equations in gravitational theory and mechanics, while quantum mechanics, often labeled postmodern, uses a linear fundamental equation, the Schrödinger equation. Applications of chaos theory to fields like business management or literary analysis often border on absurd, particularly when confusing mathematical chaos with the colloquial meaning of disorder. For example, claims that organizational behavior can be understood through chaos theory typically ignore the precise mathematical meaning of chaos in favor of vague analogies about unpredictability. Similarly, attempts to apply fractal mathematics to literary texts often mistake superficial pattern recognition for meaningful analysis. The real significance of chaos theory lies not in undermining scientific rationality, but in expanding our understanding of complex systems while remaining firmly within the traditional scientific method. It demonstrates both the power and limitations of scientific prediction while reinforcing the importance of mathematical rigor in understanding natural phenomena. Gödel's theorem has become an inexhaustible source of intellectual abuse across various disciplines, serving as a prime example of how mathematical concepts can be misappropriated and distorted when taken out of their original context. The theorem, which specifically addresses the limitations of formal mathematical systems, has been stretched far beyond its legitimate scope to make sweeping claims about politics, society, and human nature. Social critic Régis Debray provides a particularly striking example in his Critique of Political Reason, where he dramatically claims that collective madness finds its ultimate foundation in the logical axiom of incompleteness. Debray presents this as the secret of our collective miseries and the a priori condition of any political history, framing it as an extension of Gödel's theorem that states no organized system can be closed by elements internal to that system alone. This interpretation fundamentally misunderstands both the technical content and the proper scope of Gödel's work, which deals specifically with formal systems in mathematical logic and their ability to prove their own consistency. The misappropriation becomes even more problematic when Debray uses this flawed understanding to draw spectacular but unfounded conclusions about political systems. He argues that government of the people by the people is logically contradictory, and that a demystified society would be a pulverized society. These assertions represent a double error, first in misinterpreting Gödel's theorem, and then in applying this misinterpretation to social and political phenomena that bear no meaningful relationship to formal mathematical systems. The intellectual abuse spreads further as other thinkers build upon these misappropriations. Philosopher Michel Serres compounds the error by elevating Debray's misuse to a Gödel-Debray principle, claiming it frees us from ancient models, though it's unclear what models these might be or how Gödel's theorem could possibly relate to them. Similarly, philosopher Alain Badiou makes an even more perplexing leap, attempting to connect the continuum hypothesis in set theory to immigrant workers and trade union realism, creating a bizarre and logically incoherent bridge between abstract mathematics and concrete social issues. These examples reveal a troubling pattern in contemporary intellectual discourse, the tendency to appropriate complex mathematical concepts with precise technical meanings and apply them arbitrarily to social and political domains where they have no legitimate application. This practice often involves multiple layers of misunderstanding. First, a fundamental misunderstanding of the mathematical concept itself. Second, an unjustified extension of this concept beyond its proper domain. And finally, the drawing of sweeping conclusions based on these compounded errors. The result isn't the kind of genuine interdisciplinary insight that can emerge from careful analysis and legitimate analogies. Instead, it produces intellectual confusion masquerading as profound analysis, often clothed in the authoritative language of mathematics, but lacking any real mathematical or logical foundation. This pattern of abuse not only misleads readers, but also undermines the potential for genuine cross-disciplinary understanding and application of mathematical concepts.
Rather than inhibiting interaction between mathematical physical sciences and human sciences, we should emphasize necessary preconditions for meaningful dialogue. The fears on both sides can be alleviated by distinguishing between grandiose claims and modest accomplishments. 7 principles can guide productive cross-disciplinary engagement. First, know what you're talking about when discussing natural sciences. Second, recognize that obscurity doesn't equal profundity. Third, science isn't just a text providing metaphors. Fourth, social sciences shouldn't ape natural sciences. They have their own methods. Fifth, be wary of argument from authority. Evaluate propositions based on facts and reasoning, not the status of advocates. Sixth, distinguish between specific skepticism about particular theories and radical skepticism about all knowledge. Finally, beware of ambiguity as subterfuge. Texts that can be interpreted as either banal truths or radical falsehoods, allowing authors to retreat to innocuous interpretations when challenged. The intellectual sources of postmodernism and relativism are complex. Several key factors include, first, the neglect of empirical evidence. While pure empiricism is rightly criticized, theories must still be justified through observation and experiment, not merely through coherent language or mathematical formalism. Second, scientism in social sciences. The illusion that simplistic, objective methods can solve complex problems has paradoxically led to anti-scientific reactions when these methods inevitably fail. Third, natural sciences' prestige leads some scientists to make unjustified claims while giving the public a distorted view of scientific activity. Fourth, methodological relativism in anthropology, studying customs without judgment, has been confused with radical cognitive relativism, claiming all belief systems are equally true. Finally, traditional philosophical and literary training can be a handicap when approaching scientific texts, as it emphasizes authorship and textual analysis over factual arguments. The paradoxical relationship between postmodernism and the political left reveals deeper issues. Historically, the left championed science against obscurantism. But recently, many leftist academics have embraced epistemic relativism. This shift stems from several sources. First, new social movements, black liberation, feminism, gay rights, reacting against traditional leftist orthodoxies, sometimes mistakenly rejected rationality along with narrow economic determinism. Second, political discouragement in the face of triumphant capitalism has led some intellectuals to retreat into academic cults divorced from reality rather than confront difficult problems. Third, science became an easy target, sufficiently linked to power structures to seem unsympathetic, yet accessible enough to attack. We must distinguish between legitimate critiques of science, as institution, technology, or fallible knowledge, and misguided attacks on rationality itself. By abandoning reason, the postmodern left deprives itself of tools for criticizing social order while delighting those in power who monopolize these instruments. Postmodernism has 3 principal negative effects. wasting time in the human sciences, creating cultural confusion that favors obscurantism, and weakening the political left. While postmodernism poses no immediate threat to natural sciences, it seriously harms social sciences when fashionable nonsense and word games displace the critical and rigorous analysis of social realities. The deliberately obscure discourses poison intellectual life and strengthen anti-intellectualism. For the left, postmodernism isolates intellectuals in sterile debates, discredits progressive politics through association with confused ideas, and makes social critique logically impossible due to subjectivist presuppositions. If all discourses are merely stories with equal validity, there's no foundation for criticizing existing social orders or opposing prejudice. Having begun as a challenge to orthodoxies in the 1960s, postmodernism has now become institutionalized, with revolutionary ideas degenerating into a vulgate that mixes bizarre confusions with overblown banalities. Our hope lies in the emergence of an intellectual culture that would be rationalist but not dogmatic, scientifically minded but not frivolous, and politically progressive but not sectarian. In a world increasingly dominated by science and technology, intellectual clarity isn't merely an academic virtue, it's a political necessity. When we surrender rational discourse to those in power, we abandon our most powerful tool for social critique. The defense of reason isn't conservative nostalgia, but the precondition for meaningful progressive politics. As Sokol and Brickmont remind us, there is nothing truthful, wise, humane, or strategic about confusing hostility to injustice with hostility to science and rationality.